Muchos muchachos están viviendo la vida loca, mujeres buenas, carro del año y marca de ropa. En vacaciones te fuiste de viaje por Europa junto con mucho licor y con mucha coca.
Eva, thank you so much for being part of this documentary, which we feel is so important to get a balanced view of Chavez and Venezuela to the American public. One of the biggest things, one of the biggest accusations against Chavez in the United States is he's anti-democratic, that he is a tyrant, a dictator. But through years of research, literally, that you've gone through, you've found quite the opposite, and in fact a very dedicated demonization campaign against Chavez in Venezuela. Please tell us about that.
Well, first of all, those characterizations of Hugo Chavez couldn't be further from the truth. This is a country that today enjoys more democracy than ever before in history, where people that previously were excluded today are the principal protagonists of the political process, have access to all the different government institutions, and in fact have become a part of them. I mean, there's been a transfer of the power to the people. Part of the reason why there's this whole demonization campaign is precisely because of that taking place here. What Noam Chomsky refers to as the threat of a good example of this type of process, transformation, revolution taking place in a country that throughout almost its entire history, since its independence, has been colonized by imperial forces. Before the independence, it was Spain, and after, it became the United States, which is what really consolidated in the 20th century. And of course, Venezuela is the country just last month, or at the beginning of 2010, the U.S. Geological Service, the U.S. government agency, determined that Venezuela has the largest reserves of oil on the planet. So you can imagine that that also affects, that affects U.S. interests, it affects U.S. policy towards Venezuela. It wasn't an issue in prior years before Chavez came to power because governments were subordinate to U.S. agenda. By what Hugo Chavez has done, in addition to promoting and leading this revolution of people's power, is also turned Venezuela into a sovereign state where it's no longer dependent or subordinate to the United States or to any multinational power, be it corporate or governmental.
Well, before we talk about your research, tell us, you were here before the revolution, and of course you live here now. Tell us some of the differences since Chavez came into power in 1998.
The biggest difference, of course, is the level of participation of the people. Just like in the United States, in Venezuela before 1998, people were in the majority apathetic, didn't participate in anything because they didn't feel like their participation had any value or any impact. But beyond that, people were excluded. Primarily poor people had no access to voting because they didn't have identification cards. They weren't allowed to register to vote. So they didn't actually even have the right to participate in the political process. There was tremendous devaluation in the currency, the Venezuelan currency, the Bolivar, that took place during the years prior to the Chavez administration, due to the bad economic policies of prior governments and mismanagement of funds. In fact, the president in the early 90s, late 80s and early 90s, Carlos Andres Perez, who was in power, was impeached for corruption in 1993, precisely because he had stolen all this money from the state, and he fled to Miami, which is where he's remained ever since as a fugitive from justice. Governments before the revolution were repressive, dangerously repressive. 60s and 70s saw thousands of tortured and disappeared in Venezuela. That continued through the 80s and 90s. Curfews, national curfews were frequent, suspension of constitutional guarantees, military, a forced military draft in a country with no military enemy or even a really equipped military force. I mean, it's just a way really to repress the people and exclude the majority, so that what was created here during 40 years since the fall of the dictatorship in 1958 was a political system run by the economic elite that was completely in line and connected with the U.S. elite, the corporate elite, and multinational elite. And so that was how it was before. How is it now? Well, now we have a government that is completely opposed to any form of repression, to the extent where some say, for example, President Lula of Brazil says that there's an excess of democracy in Venezuela. People are free to take to the streets and in protest. They don't face any kind of repression, nowhere near to what it's like in the United States. And there's much more access to government, to, of course, again, the topic of participation in the political policy, which is encouraged by the president himself on a daily basis. People are empowered. Their lives have been transformed. The government's focus is on the most needy and has been and continues to be until their situations are resolved. Programs that have been put into place, social programs in the areas of healthcare and education and job skills training and subsidized food markets and sports and recreation and culture are, you know, geared towards all of Venezuelans, but particularly those that have never had access to those different areas that encompass the basic necessities of being a human being. So I think the biggest changes have been in the simple expression of human dignity.
I read an article by someone named Jose Miguel Vivanco, and he's the Venezuelan correspondent for Human Rights Watch. And in this article, he says that people who protest are put in prisons in Venezuela. And then if the judges release them, then the judges are fired. Can you answer to that?
First of all, Jose Miguel Vivanco, who's the Latin American director for Human Rights Watch, forms part of a coordinated campaign of manipulation and of aggression towards Venezuela. It's not just Human Rights Watch. It's also other alleged defenders of human rights that have been a part of this continuous and very dangerous campaign to demonize the Venezuelan government, President Chavez particularly, and to distort and minimize the reality of what's taking place here so that the truth really doesn't get out. Particularly, Jose Miguel Vivanco has taken the case of Venezuela in his own hands and has also been publishing reports over the past several years that attempt to paint this picture of the Chavez government as repressive and violating constantly human rights. Nevertheless, they've never once recognized the advances made in the area of human rights, because we must remember, what are human rights? Human rights under international law are civil rights, political rights, and social, economic, and cultural rights. Mm-hmm. They're not just mm-hmm. civil and political rights. Mm-hmm. In the United States, the U.S. only recognizes civil and political rights, which means that in the United States you do not have human rights. Mm-hmm. Venezuela's constitution guarantees all those areas of rights. And so, yes, we have political protesters here that on occasion have been arrested for short time periods, but that's because they've committed crimes. We don't have any political prisoners in Venezuela today. Political prisoners are a thing of the past. Just because you're a politician and you commit a crime doesn't make you a political prisoner. If you engage in some kind of violence or destruction of property, or you plot to assassinate the president, and then charges are brought against you, you can't then claim a status as a political prisoner whose rights are violated. But all of that is distorted in reports such as these by Human Rights Watch, which also is important to point out that on the board of directors of Human Rights Watch, you'll find the same faces and names of those that are on the boards of directors of the companies that comprise the military-industrial complex.
For example,
Lockheed Martin, Boeing, and the major, you know, suppliers of defense equipment, those that are interested also in encouraging conflict in Venezuela and South America so they can profit from it. There are also those connected to Venezuelan opposition groups, particularly the Cisneros group of companies, Gustavo Cisneros, who's one of the biggest media owners in all of Latin America. He's the wealthiest man in Venezuela. His members of his company sit on the board of Human Rights Watch. Others that are connected to U.S. agencies, ranging from former presidents from Latin America that now reside in the U.S. and work on these think tanks that, you know, are aligned with imperial interests, sit on the board of directors or fund Human Rights Watch. agencies, foundations that receive their funding from the State Department fund Human Rights Watch. So you always have to look at the chain, the web and network of connections between these organizations. What they say is generally forms a part of what the interests are of those that fund and support them.
What does this have to do with the CFR?
Well, exactly. That's exactly one of the
same
other
kind of
agencies, people. Organizations, members of the Council of Foreign Relations also sit on the board of advisors.
Which is a Rockefeller Foundation.
Which receive funding, again, from the Rockefeller Foundation, from the Carnegie Foundation, from the Ford Foundation, that when you trace back where is their original funding coming from and who are the interests behind that, you find the same group of people. It's like what I call the empire's web. It's all the same agencies and foundations and institutions and media conglomerates, politicians or governmental interests, financial institutions, multinational corporations, military industrial complex, that in the end it boils down to a small group of probably under 1,000 people that are the same running all of those different entities. And so then, of course, it's their interests that are the ones being promoted through the facades of, you know, these other organizations that then put out this picture, Human Rights Watch, we are defenders of human rights. But in the end, if they were defenders of human rights, why would they then be backing those that have been involved in ongoing destabilization attempts to overthrow a democratically elected government in Venezuela that still enjoys majority support, a mass majority support, over 60% support of its people? You know, a government that provides for health care for all of its citizens, free, that ensures that people are fed daily, that they have housing, that they have education from the basic levels to the highest levels, to doctoral programs for free. You know, a government that cares about its people. That's what human rights is about. Mm-hmm. That people have access to media and freedom of expression. What is freedom of expression? Is freedom of expression the expression of the owners of the press? Or is it the expression of the people? You know, in Venezuela, we believe that freedom of expression is the expression of those whose voices need to be heard, those whose voices have previously been, you know, denied and ignored, and that it's not about media owners' rights, it's about the people's rights and the people's access to those media. So in Venezuela, you know, for example, there's an excess also of freedom of expression, because Venezuela respects the rights of the media owners almost in the same way as the rights of the people, which has been an issue of contention. But I think it's important, again, to go back to the initial question, that the demonization in this campaign, very carefully and strategically coordinated, that has been escalating over 5 years against the Venezuelan government as the revolution here is consolidated and is now expanding throughout the region and taking on a new form of a Latin American community and a unity free from the meddling and the control of the United States, that the fear and the threat that U.S. interests feel and imperialist interests feel has increased to the point where now they're desperate in their actions and to stop it from advancing further, to stop these revolutions and these people's uprisings from achieving their final goal, which is, you know, the true liberation from the dominant forces and powers and the true realization of a socialist society, in this case socialism being social and economic justice. So we've seen this campaign, it's what I've particularly been studying and investigating for years, and through documents from the United States government, agencies, public statements, as well as other sources that I've found over the years. And it's clear that, for example, the Human Rights Watch reports coming out of the Inter-American Commission on Human Rights from the Organization of American States, which just published a whopping 322-page report slamming Venezuela, also in the area of human rights. It's no coincidence that that happens the same time that José Miguel Vivanco makes statements, that the State Department declares grave concerns about democracy in Venezuela, that the Drug Enforcement Administration publishes its annual report saying that Venezuela is implicated in drug trafficking and transit and money laundering, that the State Department and other agencies claim that Venezuela is funding terrorist activities. This is all connected to this campaign to discredit the Chavez government, to isolate it, and to justify aggressions against Venezuela. And the aggressions have the final goal, of course, of just destroying the revolution so that the imperialist interests can regain their control over the largest oil reserves in the world and stop that threat of a good example from actually becoming reality.
This is a very interesting aspect, too, because in 2002, there was a coup attempt. And it was successful for about 2 days. And if Hugo Chavez was anti-democratic, if he was a dictator, why would the people literally throng into the streets? Because it happened in Honduras, and Zelaya still hasn't been returned to power. But within a couple days, Chavez was returned to power by the people.
The coup d'etat that took place on April 11, 2002, was funded, supported, and equipped by the United States government.
And you have actual documents.
And through my investigation, I have documents that I've obtained under the Freedom of Information Act from the Central Intelligence Agency, the U.S. State Department, and the Pentagon that confirm without a doubt that the U.S. had funded, supported, had prior knowledge of the coup, and was involved with the military officers, the dissident military officers that executed the coup together with civilian and media forces in the country. What happened? Well, they miscalculated. They miscalculated what was really happening in the country. It's sort of the empire's mentality that, you know, those that it's dominated for so many years couldn't possibly have a voice or a will of their own. Mm-hmm. And they underestimated the capacity of the Venezuelan people. They underestimated the leadership of Hugo Chavez. They underestimated what really this revolution means to the people of Venezuela. And that when that happened on April 11, 2002, and on April 12th, when this man, Pedro Carmona, who in a U.S. State Department document was classified as the right man for the right time in Venezuela 5 months before the coup, mm-hmm. when he swore himself in as president of Venezuela, and the Venezuelan people saw the same elite that had repressed them for over 40 years steal power mm-hmm. after they'd stolen everything from the country, they said, no way. There's no way that after we've fought peacefully and democratically to come to power, we now have a voice, we are now visible, that you are going to make us invisible again. It's just not going to happen. And so the people took to the streets in an absolutely unprecedented historical event that has never happened anywhere else in the world. The Venezuelan people, primarily the poor, the previously excluded, and together with the loyal armed forces. And one of the key differences between what happened in Venezuela in 2002 and what happened in Honduras in 2009 was precisely that civil-military unity. Mm-hmm. The Venezuelan armed forces come from the people, come from the grassroots, come from the poor neighborhoods. And in prior years, before Chavez, yes, they were ordered to repress the people, but a lot of them didn't like that because those are their people, which is why, part of why Chavez, you know, came to power with so much support from so many different sectors, including the military. And so on April 13th, 2002, the people took to the streets and demanded Chavez's return to power. And it was together with the loyal military forces that he was rescued. He also had been kidnapped and was going to be assassinated. Mm-hmm. And he was rescued by his loyal armed forces and by the people of this nation that refused to let the empire take away their revolution and their dignity. And the U.S. had backed the whole thing and was behind the whole thing. No surprise, because there hasn't been one coup d'etat in the history of Latin America or the world where there hasn't been some U.S. meddling and involvement. And this certainly was the case, and it's well documented. In my book, The Chavez Code, documents are there, and people can see them for themselves. One of the other main sort of forms of support that the U.S. gave during that moment that has actually escalated since then has been funding of opposition groups and of political interests and parties and organizations that seek to overthrow the Chavez administration or destabilize it from within. through the National Endowment for Democracy, a congressionally funded agency, and the U.S. Agency for International Development, USAID, mm-hmm. and a series of other groups that it funds, Freedom House and the International Republican Institute and a whole bunch of others. Over the past 7 years, there's been more than $50 million of your money, U.S. taxpayer dollars, or others that pay taxes, the people of the United States. The monies have gone into destabilizing a country, a democratic nation, whose people in the majority support their president just because it's not convenient for the United States. It's not a government convenient to the United States. And this works through funding of these different NGOs and political parties to consolidate them, to strengthen them, to help them with their political campaigns. Every electoral campaign in Venezuela since Chavez was elected and before, actually, but it's increased now, has been funded by the United States. The opposition side has been funded by the United States. This year, for example, we have legislative elections in September, on September 26th, and so far $15 million of U.S. taxpayer money has been destined to fund the opposition campaign to take back the National Assembly.
And let's talk about the National Endowment for Democracy, because like Human Rights Watch, it sounds like a very positive adventure. We're going to go around the world and we're going to endow democracy. Talk about that agency. And you talked about what they're doing in Venezuela, but Venezuela is not the only place that they're operating. But talk about the National Endowment for
The National Endowment for Democracy was created in 1983 by congressional legislation. It came out of a project of the American Political Foundation, which was created by the Reagan administration, to find a way to continue the activities that the CIA had been conducting the two decades prior, primarily in Latin America, to stop the spread of communism, but to do it with a facade that was legitimate. Mm-hmm. Because during the 70s, after the Church Commission investigations and the discovery of CIA involvement in the coup against Salvador Allende and then a series of other different interventions, the Congress created two committees in the House and the Senate to oversee intelligence operations and to somehow limit them a little bit. So they tried to find a way that was more legitimate, would be easier to do, to conduct activities that primarily involved penetrating and infiltrating civil society and promoting organizations that act as U.S. agents in foreign nations, but to do it in the name of democracy. And so this came out of precisely that time and that moment. And its first application, the National Endowment for Democracy's first application, was in Nicaragua in the 1980s. And it was at the moment when the Reagan administration had come under fire for funding the paramilitary groups, the Contras, in Nicaragua, in Central America, and had the Congress had cut off their funding, and so they began selling weapons to Iran, the Iran-Contra scandal, mm-hmm. in order to continue funding those groups in Central America, which they saw as freedom fighters against the spread of communism. And so that was the original purpose of the National Endowment for Democracy, and in fact, it achieved its goal. The National Endowment for Democracy was used to oust the Sandinistas from power through democratic means, through an electoral process. But that was concluded after 7 years of this penetration and agitation in what's called civil society, political parties and media and even church groups and NGOs, to create new ones. Over $1 billion was spent actually during that time period, the decade of the 80s, through the National Endowment for Democracy and its core groups that it works with to oust the Sandinistas from power. And then that model was successful, so it was replicated in other parts. And generally what the National Endowment for Democracy does is brings together these different aspects of civil society, the NGOs and the political parties and the church groups and the media and other forces, and helps them to create a political coalition that's capable then of overthrowing or ousting or by whatever means, be it a coup, be it a constitutional coup, like mm-hmm. they saw in the case of Honduras, or an electoral process. And today, yes, the National Endowment for Democracy operates in over 70 countries around the world. Its budget comes directly from Congress and is overseen by the State Department, yet it presents itself in a very deceptive way as a non-governmental private organization that promotes democracy. Mm-hmm. 25 years ago, or almost 30 years ago, or well, a little over 25 years ago, one of its founding members said that what the National Endowment for Democracy does today, which continues to be the same today in 2010, is what the CIA did 25 years ago. And so it's basically an outpost, an arm of the CIA that conducts this work of subversion and destabilization of democratic governments that are unfavorable to U.S. interests. And I guarantee you, any country that has a government that, and I know this actually for a fact, that is inconvenient to U.S. interests, you will find the National Endowment for Democracy present in that country, funding groups that are promoting U.S. agenda.
All of their, you know, funding in Venezuela and their work in Venezuela, I can see it with my own eyes. Why, after 12 years, have they not been successful in overthrowing Chavez? But there are elections coming up. Chavez's popularity is still very high at 60%, but it's not as high as it used to be.
There have been ongoing destabilization attempts since the coup in 2002, which was the first one. We've had severe economic sabotages, a shutdown of the oil industry in late 2002 into 2003. We have a very intense and powerful media war going on internally in Venezuela and then also externally with that coordinated campaign to demonize the government and distort Venezuela's reality. There have been elections, interventions in all of the elections to back the opposition campaigns. And what the agencies have concluded, the U.S. agencies have concluded, is yes, that they had underestimated the popularity of President Chavez and the strength and importance of the revolution to the people of Venezuela. So the newer tactics are, of course, multi-level, many simultaneously taking place, have become much more dangerous and much more aggressive. The National Endowment for Democracy, together with USAID, which has what's called an Office for Transition Initiatives here in Venezuela, it was set up in 2002 after the coup, and through that, all this multi-million-dollar funding is directed and filtered, channeled to the groups that it works with here. The tactics of today, in addition to supporting the opposition, the public face of the opposition and its party and its candidates, is to penetrate the revolutionary forces, just like was done in the 1960s and 70s in the United States against social movements, the Black Panther Party and the American Indian Movement and the Students for Democratic Society and those that were fighting for real change and transformation in the U.S. Those are tactics today that are applied here in Venezuela, penetrating and infiltrating our United Socialist Party, the PSUV, trying to promote internal divisions and conflicts, trying to recruit members that, you know, of the government or of the party or of the revolution to become agents of the U.S. And it's worked in some occasions. Mm-hmm. There was a political party here that was aligned with the revolution from the beginning in 1998 that was created during the revolution called Podemos. And in 2005, the U.S. agencies began to work closely with them and provide them with funding and captivate them with different programs and donations. And by 2007, the party joined with the opposition and left the revolution. So, and penetration in the neighborhoods, in the communities, and trying to build parallel programs like our community councils, which are sort of the fuel of the revolution. Mm-hmm. The opposition forces and the U.S. agencies have been working to create parallel programs that are called social networks or popular people's networks that are in the neighborhoods actively working, that in some cases, you know, bringing money. They're engaging in what really is populism. Populism, in the end, is about, you know, just immediately trying to gratify the people so they're going to vote for you. Mm-hmm. The Chavez government isn't actually a populist government. I mean, it's a revolutionary socialist government that is providing long-term solutions that it's not just directing. Mm-hmm. It's engaging with and creating from the grassroots with the people. So there, it's become more dangerous, the mechanisms of subversion and destabilization. And yes, while they haven't succeeded, they're looking for these new ways to debilitate the revolution and destroy it from within, at the same time increasing the public aggression from the State Department, from Washington, from the Pentagon, and this massive military escalation on behalf of the U.S. in the region, which is a direct threat towards Venezuela.
That brings up a question, an obvious question. But first of all, Podemos, does that mean yes, we can? Something like that?
Yes, it does.
See? And but an obvious question is, why are these agencies allowed to operate in Venezuela?
That is a very good question, Cindy. Venezuela doesn't have on the books a law that formally prohibits that type of funding. It does prohibit, of course, funding from a foreign government to engage in treason. Mm-hmm. And some of the groups, one in particular by the name of Sumate, that has been one of the most funded by the United States, who in fact now they're president of that organization is a candidate to the National Assembly this year. They were brought up on charges in 2004 for treason. But the campaign that the U.S. State Department and the White House conducted was so powerful that it brought together high-level representatives from European nations as well as from organizations all around the world, the World Bank, pressuring the Venezuelan government in pressuring the Attorney General's office, pressuring also our Supreme Court, that all funding would be cut off for programs that at that time Venezuela still was receiving funding from the World Bank for programs for judicial reform and all kinds of different things that they had established going on. And internally, the pressure against the individual members in the National Assembly who, you know, were also a part of the investigation into this group and the classification of it for treason, the pressure helped to diminish then the level of eagerness of the government to continue with the case against this organization. And one of the key prosecutors actually on that case, but also on the case of all those who were involved in the coup that were also receiving funding, that my investigations, for example, had helped to provide evidence to show the direct link between the U.S. and their actions that also showed treason. The prosecutor that was working on that case in 2004 was assassinated in a terrorist act. His Danilo Anderson was his name, and he was blown up in his vehicle on November 18, 2004. So all these different tactics of intimidation and pressure aided in ceasing any kind of action taken against those groups that received this funding. Nevertheless, President Chavez did try to include in a constitutional reform in 2007 an article that would prohibit all foreign funding for political activities in the country. However, the reform was not passed in a popular referendum. It lost by less than a point. So it's an issue. There's a law that's in debate in the National Assembly here in Venezuela. But it's an issue still of grave concern because it's one of the areas that what I call the silent invasion. It's not the military bases and the threat that we see coming from Colombia and the U.S. bases in the Caribbean. And it's not the verbal public hostile declarations that we can hear and we can read from the Pentagon representatives in the State Department and from the White House. So it's not visible. It's invisible. But it's here, and it's almost more dangerous because it's inside Venezuela. And it's something that has gone beyond just consolidating the opposition to try to debilitate and destroy the revolution from within.
Well, then that leads to another obvious question. In my interview with President Chavez, he's been president for 12 years now, and he's going to be seeking another term in 2012. But he said that only about 10% of what he wanted to achieve, what he wants to achieve, has been achieved. Is that because all of these forces that you just talked about?
It's important to remember that when President Chavez came to power in 98, this was basically a country in ruins. It was a country that the elite that had been running the government for 40-some years had literally abandoned. Had abandoned infrastructure, had abandoned the people's needs, mm-hmm. Had destroyed the economy, had shut down all other industry except the oil industry because that's where the most profit was coming from. So Venezuela was importing 80% of its consumer products. It had no more agricultural industry. And, you know, this level of poverty had grown to almost 80%. So the Chavez government had to deal with the necessary, the immediate first, which was the mass misery and poverty in the country and how to address the people's needs at the most basic level. The first stage, of course, though, was rebuilding a structure. A country can't exist without a political and economic and social infrastructure. And so that came with the creation of our new constitution, which was, in fact, the first sort of demonstration of the fact that this is a true participatory democracy, because it was a constitution that was drafted, written by the people, for the people, and ratified by the people in a popular referendum in 1999. Mm-hmm. And it's a constitution of over 350 articles and now one amendment that articulates the largest number of human rights of any other constitution in the entire world. And so once that was created and we had that, we have the sort of the spinal cord of the nation built again, mm-hmm. rehabilitated, then laws had to be passed that would enable for those rights to be implemented. Mm-hmm. And that began to take place in 2000 and in 2001. And Chavez had to run again for election in 2000 under the new constitution. Mm-hmm. And then in 2001, the new laws and new programs began. But then in 2002, yeah, we had the coup. And then at the end of the year, we had this severe economic sabotage and shutdown of the oil industry that caused over $20 billion in damages. So then we had to focus on recuperating the economy. And in 2003, the social missions were born, Mission Barrio Adentro and Mission Robinson, which are dedicated to healthcare and education, attending to the needs of the most miserable and poor in the country. And so that began taking place in 2003. And in 2004, there was a recall referendum against President Chavez. So again, another campaign, mm-hmm. and resources going to that at the same time, trying to deal with, you know, the people's needs. But yes, this ongoing destabilization has in some ways slowed down the advances, but it certainly hasn't stopped them. Mm-hmm. I mean, when we look back to the Venezuela of 2010 and the Venezuela of 1998, they're two different countries, and it's just completely different. There's been a radical transformation. That's what a revolution is. It's a transformation of every aspect of society. But yeah, certainly the fact that we have electoral processes almost every year, which is a sign of our vibrant democracy, but also, you know, it can be harrowing on the people and on the resources and on the government itself in terms of its advances. But beyond that, I mean, it's really more about the massive level of work that needs to be done. Now the government is rebuilding the agricultural industries with the help of other nations that are transferring technology, you know, with the Latin American integration that's been promoted first by Venezuela, continuing the dream of Simón Bolívar, the liberator of Venezuela and other countries in the region, of creating this, the La Patria Grande, the big homeland of an integrated and unified Latin America and Caribbean region. And with that has come all these different exchanges and commercial trade and between nations that is allowing for Venezuela to rebuild its agricultural industry, to create beyond just Latin America relations with countries such as Iran and Russia and China and Vietnam and Malaysia and African nations. For the first time, Venezuela has consulates and embassies in the African nations. It didn't have that before. Now we have a direct relation. If you look at it geographically, we're right across from each other. I mean, it's closer from Brazil to Cabo Verde and Cape Verde, Cape Green, or whatever it's called in English, than it is up to, you know, the U.S. So we're now creating those relations, creating and bringing to reality the global South. And having it not just be something that's about, you know, a cultural exchange, but a political and economic and a technological exchange. So that now Venezuela, for example, with Iran, is capable of building cars here. We had all the raw material. The governments before didn't care about that industry because it's not a big profit-making industry. So they never invested in it. But the Chavez government does because it wants, beyond just rebuilding industry and having access to consumer products, that's about it's an issue that is about sovereignty of a nation, that we can have food security and food sovereignty by having our own agricultural industry and not being dependent on the U.S., which was Venezuela's primary trade partner, mm-hmm. have technological sovereignty in the area of automobiles. With China, they helped us build a satellite, a telecommunications satellite, which was launched last year. Venezuela now has its own satellite. While it may not sound like anything to people in the United States that have thousands of satellites, it's huge mm-hmm. for Latin American nations and for Venezuela, which was dependent on other countries. Now we can have sovereign telecommunications. Now we can build our own telephone industry, satellite telephones. We can build our own internet servers. And we can transfer technology also via satellite to other nations. I mean, these are huge advances that are taking place that, you know, yes, 10%, says Chavez, because we still have a whole country to build. Mm-hmm. While we're dealing with industries and you know, issues relating to people's needs and healthcare and in education and in job training, we're also trying to build a new model of society that's based on communal living. And so that brings in a whole other aspect of, you know, this 10%. We're trying to build a socialism for the 21st century where the power resides in the people, where in the end, while yes, right now we have a government that transfers resources down to the people, the eventual idea is that it become a horizontal process, that in the end there may not even be a need 20 years down the line for all these government institutions, that community councils and connected with communes, regional communes, are the ones running their industries and their economies and, you know, exchanging with one another and then making those relations also come to light with other nations that are building similar models. So the level of work here is so immense that, yeah, the 10% that's been done is absolutely extraordinary. But there's so much more to do because the project that we have here in Venezuela is a very ambitious project, but it's an essential project. It's about rebuilding humanity.
You know, I've witnessed the empowerment of Venezuelan people with my own eyes, and it's very inspirational. And I do want, the last thing we want to talk about is the media here, of course. In the United States, we're told that Chavez oppresses, represses the media, you know, that he's a tyrant that way. But before we talk about that, and you said that eventually, you know, the goal is to have a horizontal society. There's more governmental and grassroots participation in Venezuela, of course, than in the United States. What keeps President Chavez grounded to the people? And it doesn't get this, you know, a lot of leaders would have good intentions of doing that. And we see it in the United States. But then they get corrupted. They get corrupted by the power. They get corrupted by the money. And it becomes, you know, a top-down that it's not even top-down. It's top and stays at the top. In the United States, it doesn't filter down at all. What keeps Chavez grounded to this principle of sharing power with the people? Principle of sharing power in the United States is almost unheard of.
Hugo Chavez comes from the people. I think that's what keeps him most rooted in the reality of the country and in the entire purpose of what he's doing and what his long-term vision is for this nation. And beyond that, he himself has said when he was rescued by the people of Venezuela on April 13th, he knew from then on that he owed his life to them. Mm-hmm. He was going to be killed.
Right.
So I think that that's, for him, that was just a huge awakening mm-hmm. that he saw, you know, from that moment on, that his life was, he owed his life to the people. And that if the people were so willing to come out and sacrifice everything they had for him, it's the least he could do to do the same.
It was very dangerous to come out because there had been...
Well, they were killing
people. Right, they were killing people, for sure.
They were killing people during the...
Yes.
Absolutely.
And I've seen people say with their... that they would die to defend Chavez and the revolution. And that's what happened on April 13th.
That's how people here feel. Because it's not just about Hugo Chavez, the man. It's about everything that he represents. Mm-hmm. It's about what he's been able to do. I think that while, yes, we're trying to build this horizontal model, which is the final goal, there's no question that the charisma, the leadership, and the vision of Hugo Chavez, the man, is what has made this happen. He's propelled by the force of the people. It's not just Hugo Chavez doing this, but he's had the vision and the immense heart. I mean, it's really, in the end, this is a revolution based on love. Mm-hmm. And he recites often a statement of Bolivar, and also of Simon Bolivar, which is, you do it with love, you receive it back with love. Amor con amor se paga. And that is genuinely true. And anyone who has ever witnessed in person Hugo Chavez interact with anybody knows that what he says and what he does comes from his heart. And he makes a direct contact with the people. He doesn't ignore people. He doesn't brush them off. He doesn't blow them off. You know, he doesn't treat them as something beneath him because he doesn't believe that they are anything beneath him. And yes, while there's fear of, you know, cult personality or focusing everything on one person, we also have to understand that and be grateful for the fact that extraordinary human beings do exist, and Hugo Chavez is one of them. And so I think, you know, that that recognition of what he means to people, and that the people of Venezuela, despite all that's in between, because I'll be the first to admit that Hugo Chavez may be that way, but not everyone in his government is. Mm-hmm. And that's also a cause for why things haven't progressed as fast as we had wished or would wish, because not everyone is, unfortunately, an extraordinary, humane person with that kind of vision and with that kind of connection to humanity.
Well, the vision is the same as the people's, which helps. And you're right. I have been had an extensive meeting with Barack Obama, with George Bush, and President Chavez. And the difference between the three of them is that when George Bush and Barack Obama speak, they might be saying words that you want to hear, but their eyes don't match. Their heart and their eyes don't match what they're saying. And this is very unscientific and very, you know, non-political or whatever. But you feel that attachment with President Chavez, that he really is genuine. Other two are not genuine.
Hugo Chavez.
He might not be perfect, but he's genuine.
An honest human being. And he's not perfect. No one is perfect. But he also recognizes his errors, which makes him even more admirable. And that's also what makes him such a capable leader in this country, is being someone who's humble enough and modest enough at the same time to recognize their errors and recognize that, yeah, we may not exactly know everything or how to do everything that we want to do, but we're trying our best. And when we make errors, we recognize that we've made those mistakes, and we move on. We find ways to move on. And part of that is because, right, he believes profoundly in this process. It's his life mission. And the people, the energy of the people, are what fuel him. They're his breath. Yeah. I mean, they're what keeps him going.
You can tell.
So the last thing that we want to talk about is the media. And, of course, when I announced I was going to come down here, we had mostly support, mostly people saying, please tell President Chavez that we support him, we love him. And we are inspired by the work that they're doing in Venezuela. But then most of the criticism we got was that he suppresses or represses the media. And people will send me articles like written by people like Jose Miguel Vivanco to justify what they're saying. Tell me about this so-called repression of Venezuela.
All you have to do in Venezuela is turn on the television or read a newspaper to see that there is a very free and ample press in this country. That repression against freedom of expression is a myth. This is a country where anyone, anywhere, anytime can say whatever they want. Things you would never hear or see on television in the United States, including calls to assassinate the president by people who are out there still walking around and all over the media. Those that were involved in the coup, none of them are in prison. They're on television still.
That's amazing.
The media played a huge role in the coup. Some are running for office, yes. There are only a few people were actually prosecuted that were the police, the Metropolitan Police under control of the opposition at the time, that were ordering the assassination of those that were in the streets at the time. Two police commissioners were tried because there was hardcore evidence of their exact involvement, and they are in prison, but they're running for office as political prisoners. I mean, it's the upside-down world, as Eduardo Galeano calls it. And certainly here in Venezuela, again, there, no media outlets have been shut down. That is another myth, a falsity, that the mass media, the corporate media internationally has, you know, been promoting that concept. RCTV is a television station that still exists. You can view it on cable television and satellite and on the internet. It had a concession to operate on the public airwaves that expired in 2007, and the government decided not to renew the concession. That happens all the time, every day, also in the United States, against all kinds of media outlets. RCTV's license wasn't renewed for many different reasons. It wasn't paying any taxes. It wasn't abiding by laws regarding its own workers and their rights. It was refusing to obey telecommunications regulations. And yes, it's a station that had played a key role in the coup d'etat against President Chavez in calling for his assassination and his ouster and, you know, instigating violence in the country. So we remember the public airwaves belong to the public, and there are rules you have to follow, and these are concessions. They're licenses that have expiration dates. Any state can choose to renew or not renew. That's not any way a violation or a repression of a media outlet if you choose not to renew their license. It doesn't mean they were shut down. They still operate. And beyond that, no newspapers have been closed down. Let me tell you, during the coup, the opposition forces that were involved in the coup d'etat shut down the Venezuelan state media because it was being run by the government at the time. They literally went on and said, this station now is going to be closed because we want it closed. We no longer want you to hear the voice of those who support Chavez. They shut down Katia TV, which is a community media station also here in Caracas. During previous governments in Venezuela, media outlets were shut down all the time. Press was closed, and freedom of expression was severely limited. So this is a government that is, in my opinion also, is over-permissive with the media. I don't think it's appropriate for anyone to go on television and call for the assassination of a president. I don't think it's appropriate for, you know, all kinds of distortions and manipulations to be constantly 24 hours repeated and recycled by the different media outlets here in the country regarding the government policies, so that what we have in Venezuela is a population that is completely disassociated from reality, that they're perception of reality is completely distinct from the actual reality they live. They believe they're living in a repressive communist state, but they know in reality that they're not, because they're going shopping in the malls all the time and going out to fancy restaurants and drinking the most expensive scotch and enjoying life and talking about how now are we going to overthrow this government. You know, that's not any kind of repressive dictatorship, marching in the streets as they please, doing whatever they want. So that it's a severe problem because it's created a type of psychosis where people are agitated and anxious because of what they view in the media. And they're missing out on all these marvelous and wonderful things taking place in their country and seeing the fact that in a country where previously people were almost embarrassed of being Venezuelan, or what was Venezuelan. If it was Venezuelan, it was less important. Are now people that treasure and honor Venezuelan culture and Venezuelan traditions and feel with dignity and pride to be a Venezuelan. Since Obama's come to power, the relations between Washington and Latin America have actually gotten worse. We've had the coup in Honduras in 2009, a military agreement between the Obama administration and the Colombian government that implies the largest military expansion of the U.S. and Latin America in history. We are now seeing in 2010, with the first reports coming out of State Department and Pentagon, the intelligence agencies and drug enforcement agencies, the language is more hostile and more aggressive against Venezuela and its allies in the region than during the 8 years of the Bush administration. So it's really just a continuing of the escalation of aggression that was already in place, but it's much more dangerous because many around the world and in the United States see the face of Obama as a much more peaceful face of empire and are unwilling to believe that he could execute the same types of policies as George W. Bush. But in Venezuela and in Latin America, we're seeing that the reality is the policies of Washington are state policies, are imperial policies.
Absolutely.
They have little to do with who's in power. And people in the U.S. need to know that with Obama, it's getting worse. The threat of some kind of military conflict in this region that's being directly promoted by Washington, by the Pentagon, is increasing on a daily basis.
Far greater than Bush. Okay, I want to answer this charge that President Chavez and President Morales of Bolivia answered so eloquently. Is President Chavez anti-American?
Hugo Chavez is anti-imperialist. He is not anti-U.S. He's expressed over and over again his love and his admiration for the people of the United States. He honors all the time the greatest leaders from the United States and those that have had important impacts on history, Martin Luther King, Malcolm X, Abraham Lincoln, because he loves many of his different speeches and words that he used to talk about the people.
Mm-hmm.
And while the times that President Chavez has been in the United States, he's had meetings with different organizations and grassroots groups and communities, primarily in New York. That's been the main place that he's gone and visited. Venezuela, because of the initiative of President Chavez, has a program in the United States that's conducted through its a corporation there, which is Citgo. It's an oil company that provides low-cost heating oil to needy families and communities throughout the United States, actually in over 15 states. So during Hurricane Katrina, Venezuela was the first to offer over $1 million in aid and also in fuel to the victims of that tragedy in New Orleans. So I think that his expressions of love for the people of Venezuela, for the people of the United States, have been frequent, have been genuine. And by no means. People in the U.S. need to understand that they live in an empire.
Absolutely.
That they form part of an empire. That if you don't do something to somehow change empire, to defeat empire, and transform the U.S. into an honorable nation, then they will continue to perpetuate those imperialist policies. And they need to understand that nations like Venezuela, Cuba, others throughout Latin America care for and feel solidarity with the people of the U.S. and want the people of the U.S. to join together and rise to the honorable status that they should have and to build with the rest of the people around the world a more humane and just society.
Thank you, Ava. That was wonderful. Thank you so much.
Muchos muchachos están viviendo la vida loca, mujeres buenas, carro del año y marca de ropa. En vacaciones te fuiste de viaje por Europa junto con mucho licor y con mucha coca. No ves que esto tu vida sofoca, te ciega los ojos, te tapa los poros y te cierra la boca. Enfoca por un segundo tu mirada hacia lo sentimental y verás que entre más avaricia de aquello no hay nada. Devalúas el alma con tantas ansias de querer poder tener más y más plata. Las ilusiones se apagan y los sueños que ayer tenía José te acaban. Ignoras su real importancia sin relevancia, palpas como te apartas de la realidad que se vive desde el salir del alba. Si la calle te impacta y tú no captas, anda, ja, baja del Mazda y camina pa' la parada y verás que del calor colapsas. Si vas en una camioneta ya saltan de lastas.
Si algún día algo malo te pasa, la calle mueve sus cartas y así te habla. La plata no te hace superior, arregla tu vida, dale una mejor proyección. Solo hace que saque de ti lo peor, sal a la calle y vive lo que es el real dolor. La calle no me hace superior, solo vivo y aprendo de cada uno una lección. Solo hace que saque de mí lo mejor y por la plata no cambiaré ni venderé mi honor. Reacciona que no eres el eje donde el mundo gira, da gracias por el aire que tu olfato respira, que te permite mantenerte con vida. Tienes tu casa y en tu casa la comida servida. Lo que no comes lo botas y lo que botes lo que otros se comen. Y si me oyen les pido que se asomen a esta realidad que a otros carcomes, y cuando sales usas gafas oscuras para no ver la verdad que para otro es tan dura como el venezolano que busca comida entre la basura, que recibe maltratos de la gente y los sapos, que solo viste unos trapos o unos sucios harapos. Y tú te quejas por tu ropa y zapatos, en tu nave paseas con los vidrios arriba porque el olor de la calle a ti te marea. Galbonero maldice porque en la calle chambea y se enfrenta a las cosas, y en esta vida pelea contra que el hambre, el asalto, la matraca y los pacos. Y en esta línea resalto que muchos han muerto por ignorancia al asfalto.
La plata no te hace superior, arregla tu vida, dale una mejor proyección. Solo hace que saque de ti lo peor, sal a la calle y vive lo que es el real dolor. La calle no me hace superior, solo vivo y aprendo de cada uno una lección. Solo hace que saque de mí lo mejor y por la plata no cambiaré ni venderé mi honor. La plata no te hace superior, arregla tu vida, dale una mejor proyección. Solo hace que saque de ti lo peor, sal a la calle y vive lo que es el real dolor. La calle no me hace superior, solo vivo y aprendo de cada uno una lección. Solo hace que saque de mí lo mejor y por la plata no cambiaré ni venderé mi honor.
No cambiaré ni venderé mi honor.
Sentimientos, sentimientos.
Breaking,
breaking.
Yeah. El Shane,
Sam,
Sam. Entre la calle y el dinero. Haciendo la calle.
Y tú lo sabes.
Haces el.
Escucha. Listen.